Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 571. Let's get right into it. We're doing it. This episode is Ed Helms returning after 2 years. I cannot believe it's been that long. Ed is, well, besides being an incredibly talented actor and comedy person, is also a bluegrass aficionado and an excellent banjo player. And he's promoting the Bluegrass Situation in L.A., which is a bluegrass music festival, October 10th and 11th, at the Ace Hotel in Los Angeles. Tickets can be found at thebluegrasssituation.com. I think if you accidentally type in Bluegrass Situation and you omit the, it will take you to thebluegrasssituation.com. They got a URL redirect, which was very smart on their part. But this Bluegrass Situation Music Festival is great. I've been to it, I performed in it, and it's super fun. So October 10th and 11th. Right now, here's Ed Helms, and there's podcast number 571.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Ed Helms, it's been, I think, maybe like 2 years since you were on the podcast the last time.
I think you're right, yeah.
What if I was just really behind? I'm like, so how's the office going? Still good?
Yes. And Chris, how is...
Singled out, great.
Singled out.
It's going really well. We're in our 21st season.
And, you're engaged to Jenny McCarthy.
Yeah.
All right.
And she just married Donnie Wahlberg, but I was like, you know, whatever. It's really funny. I was just in Chicago. I was performing in Chicago the day that she got married, and people were like, "Are you going to the wedding?" I'm like,
I think. When's the last time? What was your relationship with her like on the show?
We were friends. We were very. She was always.
Did you have a huge crush on her?
I did not have a huge crush on her. Actually,
why?
Because when I first met Jenny. I never went after the type of girl that I was always interested in was not
thinks
like,
vaccinations are good.
Yeah, that's right. So I dated a lot of veterinarians. She was the playmate was not my type of girl, and so when I first met Jenny, when they first cast her on the show, they actually had to de-playmate her because she had like acid wash jeans and like giant hair.
Oh, I got you. Yeah.
And lots of makeup, and they actually kind of like slicked her up a bit, like made her cooler. Like
MTV'd her.
Yeah, they MTV'd her. They de-playmated her, but the playmate image was always and it was just never, you know, and people never believed that when I was like. And they're like, oh, something must happen. I was like, we were never attracted to each other in that way. And they're like, come on. I'm like, it's possible that she's just not my type of girl. And they're like, oh, what are you, gay? And I'm like, yeah, because being gay is about not fucking girls that you find attractive. That's
right.
Really what that is.
Yeah.
She was just never, we just never had that kind of chemistry. It was very brother sister, but not.
Sure.
Not
incestuous.
Yeah.
Brother sister.
But not touchy pokey.
All right. Yeah. Lot of denial. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I don't know if. No, I'm saying is. No, you're the one.
I clearly touched a nerve.
Ah! No, but it was a question that.
Well, can I say at that time when I was watching MTV, very attracted to Jenny McCarthy. Yes. Yes, and singled out, and you
were attracted to me as well, and
yeah,
the show.
Sure, it's a great show.
But I was dating my girlfriend at the time. Was her name was Jacinda? She was on The Real World, London.
Okay,
and so that was, you know, Jacinda was more the, my type of girl, like tall girl.
Sure,
I don't know. It was so I was in a relationship the whole time.
Cool
as well. Never had sex with anyone from that show. Not one person.
It was like I'm trying to remember the premise. It was like sort of a cattle call dating game.
That's
right?
Exactly what it was. Yeah, it was a cattle call. It was basically an elimination, you know, like a mass elimination show.
Right, right.
Where I think their sell for it was, you know, because in real life, you know, we eliminate people based on like boob size and package size, and like the fact that there was a category, like there was a dick category where it would like package size, and then a bunch of people get eliminated. And no one ever eliminated big packages. By the way, it was always the smallest packages were.
But presumably, you didn't see people's packages.
Yes, we had a very thorough. Everyone had to see a physician.
Everyone had to have a full package analysis.
There was a measurement.
Okay,
it was sort of like, you know how like when you're growing up and your mom just like puts the little marks all the way up the door jamb.
Sure,
all the contestants had to lay down on their backs.
Got it.
And then up against a door jamb, sure. There was a your dick must be this tall to ride this ride.
Right.
Yeah. So that's exactly how that's literally how the show worked. I don't know if that was okay or legal, but I can 100% say that that's exactly what happened.
That's the charm. Mm-hmm. That's the charm.
That's right. But that show, it's funny that people still, people go, singled out. I'm like, I can't believe you. It was like 20 years ago.
At that time, I think MTV was such a kind of culture definer for people, especially like in our, what are we, X, Generation
we're
X?
Gen Xers, yeah.
Okay. So yeah, that was huge. MTV was just in that time of like, oh, they don't just play music videos. They have other cool stuff. And now we're in a place where it's like, why don't they play any music videos? All they have is lame stuff.
Well, also, we are not in the demographic anymore.
Well, I'm hip.
Yes, I'm aware. I'm also a hip person. But I think we are not.
I am deeply offended that you think MTV is not aimed at me.
It's aimed at actors ages 36 to 44 who enjoy bluegrass music.
It is so funny. You're right. Like, we just project our lack of understanding. Like, it's so funny how easy it is to not understand something and then not understand why you don't understand it. Like,
well, people who are our age now, I'm sure, were like singled out as the decline of modern civilization.
Yeah.
And it's a piece of shit. And, you know, but 15-year-old, like if you were like 12 to 22 when that show was on,
yeah,
you were, you know,
you were psyched and you wanted that and a heavy dose of Ken Ober and Remote Control.
Yeah. Oh, Remote Control was late.
Not
80s.
Ken Ober. Sorry, he was news. Or
no,
he did,
no.
He was a VJ.
No, Ken hosted Remote Control. You were right.
Okay,
Ken,
I was right
that
about
was in the
that.
Late 80s.
That was before.
It was way before.
That was
way before.
That was
like 88.
And that was Colin Quinn.
That was Colin and Adam Sandler and Kari Wurr.
See my references? How dare you say I'm not hip?
Yes. No, Kurt Loder was MTV News.
Yes, of course.
Kurt Loder and John Norris and Tabitha Soren were all MTV News.
Big crush on Tabitha Soren.
Yeah.
And then she kind of went legit. Like, she did a bunch of real news documentary kind of stuff.
Yeah,
I
don't know what she's doing now. I don't know what Tabitha's doing now.
Kennedy.
Kennedy's still around.
And who was the guy with that had the hair, like the big hair, the hair metal looking rocker?
Ricky Rackman or
he looked like a glam rock guy. He was really he had like a lion mane of hair.
Oh, you're talking about John Cencio.
John
Cencio had a lion mane of blonde hair.
Okay.
But maybe there were some others. It was such an interesting time, because now Vevo is basically where people watch or anywhere else online.
Right.
MTV was revolutionary because they had stuff that you couldn't really see anywhere else.
Now you can see
all that shit everywhere.
Right.
And people don't even have the attention spans to watch music videos anyway.
Yeah, and at the time also, like, music videos was where directors were doing incredibly out there, unusual, avant-garde things.
Like Tarsim and Mark Romanek.
Chris Cunningham and Spike Jonze. And all these guys were, like, doing exceptionally cool stuff, which is now the same stuff that networks use for their bumpers.
Right.
So it's like ubiquitous.
And it was a period of time where people would sink $1 million into a music video. Mm-hmm. Remember when Thriller came out, it was like, this video cost $1 million. Mm-hmm. But those were early 80s dollars. But still, going, into the 90s, and the music business was still like, this train's never going to stop.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
they would spend $1 million. But I think a lot of people didn't realize that so many musicians were broke a lot of the time because they had to pay for all that shit. So, like, you know, like Trent Reznor would make these fucking amazing videos, but then still have to pay for them.
Really? Like, yeah. Interscope didn't pay for that kind of stuff?
They bill it all back to the artist. It's all recoupable. So they, every dollar. It was kind of one of the fucked up things about the label business and why I think a lot of artists
right.
were like, I'd rather just sell directly to the people because
I can just email my music.
Yeah,
to
exactly.
People? Yeah,
because the record label machine was very helpful in the sense that it was the only way to really ensure that an artist could get properly promoted and put in
right.
stores and get radio play and all that stuff. But the other side of it was that, you know, like, they had to pay, everything came out of what the artists, like, the labels didn't pay for anything.
Right, right.
So I had a friend who was in a band, and he said 1 year the band got all these, like, this will tell you around when this was, but these, like, CD clock radios, like little CD player clock radios. And on their next expense statement, they noticed that they got expensed for, like, they had to pay it back. He's like, we didn't even want these. And we had to pay back
It was like a Christmas gift?
Yeah, yeah.
And they got billed for
it? They got billed for it.
That is Scrooge.
It was on their statement.
Like, that's how Scrooge operates.
Well, yes. The music industry was, you know, it created superstars, but it was, you know, largely monstrous to people. And so, you know, it was just a fucked up way to... I mean,
CD clock radios.
Yeah. I mean, there were some artists who basically, and you know, I know that on the label side, there was money that they just would never get back. I mean, it was just part of the ebb and flow of, like, well, these artists are huge and we invested money in these artists and we're never going to see it. And those artists are never going to be able to pay it back. And it's not like they would go after those artists if they got a huge advance and never made it back.
You owe us for 3 CD clock radios.
but I know that there are stories of, there was another guy who was an artist at a label, and he, you know, years later wrote a jingle for a, you know, like a car company, and was supposed to get a bunch of money, and then the record label took it because they were like, well, no, you owe us this money from before. Like, they found out that. So, you know, it's hard to feel too bad when the music industry is like, we're being bled dry. It's like, well, yeah, it doesn't feel good, does it?
Yeah, right, right.
No, you're recouping all. We're recouping all this money that you took. Your advance period was 1955 to 2003.
Right,
that was your advance period, and now we have to recoup all that. The rest of society has to recoup all that.
Payback's a bitch. Wow. Yeah. Now we're recouping.
We're recouping.
Yeah.
I love your obsession with bluegrass music. I am also obsessed with bluegrass, but I believe that you are...
But you hide it. You're a closet.
I'm not a closet. I just don't play a bluegrass instrument, so I feel like that, you know, but I do. It's one of the stations that I have on my Sirius XM presets. It's the bluegrass station.
Bluegrass Junction.
And it's fucking great.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's... I don't know. I just have always loved it, but it does, I feel like, tap a nerve that is ancient within us. You know what I mean? It's like just good folk melodies that are decades or centuries old.
Well, it's not even that, but the instrumentation, I feel like it boils down the most basic elements of how you can hear music. You have this bassy part, you have this high-end part, you have this little bit of a rhythm part, mm-hmm. and you have a percussive part.
And ideally, you've got two or three people shouting in beautiful harmony.
Yeah.
That's one of the peculiar things, I think, about bluegrass or the high lonesome sound, as it's known, like kind of traditional bluegrass, is that it takes place in a register vocally that's often very uncomfortable for the singer. So it has this like kind of raw edge to it because voices are strained a lot of times, especially those old. you gotta get up there.
Yeah.
You gotta get up. It comes from the diaphragm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Comes from deep in your scrotum.
There's not a lot of, there's not a lot of bassy bluegrass singers.
They're out there. But yeah, it's a really cool art form. And I think a lot of those guys got boned by the music industry too.
Well, yeah, because they just didn't know what to do. You know, I had some, as I mentioned them a few times on the podcast, but I had some friends of this band called the Cousin Lovers, and they would write bluegrass songs with contemporary themes and lyrics.
Right.
And they were a fucking amazing live band, like one of the most amazing live bands I've ever seen. And I remember, like, they would have this huge following around Los Angeles. Every time they played, their shows would be full. And then they went to Nashville for a while, and they were like, they didn't know what to do with us because we weren't traditional bluegrass, we weren't country.
Right.
There wasn't any place to put us.
When was that?
This was pre like internet, you know, like file sharing boom. So it was,
I think now it's
2000,
like,
2001.
Okay, yeah. Now is a incredibly exciting time for all forms of roots music, Americana, bluegrass, folk, blues, just all that stuff feels like, and I don't know if it's a response to being inundated by technology the way we are now, that people are sort of craving something simpler and a connection to an older time, but the music is thriving, and I feel like now if a band like that went to Nashville, they would be snatched up because or they wouldn't even necessarily need to go to Nashville. They could go to New York City or here in Los Angeles, because the community, the kind of acoustic music community, is really charging forward into some like exciting progressive areas. And bands like the Punch Brothers,
the Punch Brothers.
Yeah, they're just what they do musically is so profoundly intricate, and the musicality, the musicianship, I should say, is it's on par with, you know, I should finish that sentence. It's on par with Beethoven.
Well, the Punch Brothers, I pulled off the internets. They did this thing. I believe this was, maybe it was in Portland. Chamber Music Northwest. Does that sound? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Does that sound like Portland? And it's one of those places. It's basically in a place where there's usually chamber music, but the bluegrass just cuts through and bounces off the walls in such a gorgeous way.
Yeah.
And I love that. The thing that I love about how the music sounds is that it, to me, it sort of has this feeling of like some guys pulled some stuff out of a junkyard in the Appalachian Mountains and built their instruments.
Yeah.
And they basically just had whatever they could find to make sounds and then their voices, and that's it.
Yeah. And what's interesting about those guys, the Punch Brothers in particular, if you look at a picture of them, you're like, oh, it's a bluegrass band. But then when you hear them, they're all over the map, and they can do did this artist residency program at the Oberlin Conservatory, which Oberlin College is where I went, and one of the members of the Punch Brothers went there, Chris Eldridge, the guitar player. And they did this roots residency program at the conservatory, and they were working with chamber musicians and working with classical musicians and doing workshops about roots music, but also about classical music and how chamber music works and the ways in which a band, an acoustic band like the Punch Brothers, approaches an ensemble and how that relates to how a string quartet might approach. And they wound up playing this big, I saw a concert at Oberlin where the Punch Brothers played, among other things, one of the Brandenburg concertos with the members of the Oberlin Conservatory community. And it was jaw-dropping.
Is there a recording of this anywhere?
Absolutely. I don't know where, but...
to the internet!
But yes, Google. But that sort of thing, I think, is just emblematic of the excitement and progressive mentality of a lot of acoustic musicians right now. And it's why I think, even as someone who loves the traditional bluegrass sound, and really if I was like trapped on a desert island, all I would want is like a Bill Monroe CD. but I think it's, you can sort of feel the appreciation for that and this just like wave of passionate new directions. That's just this, to me, it's like, it's just as exciting. It's all from the same family. Berklee School of Music in Boston, they're churning out like, this is a serious music professional training school, and they now have a banjo program and a mandolin program, and they're churning out musicians like Sarah Jarosz, who's just crushing it out there with beautiful progressive acoustic music, but deeply rooted in bluegrass, and it's just I think it's a really exciting time.
I wonder if this, I feel like maybe it was you the last time you were on, so I apologize if I'm covering the same territory, but it was a couple of years ago, but was it you that I talked about the Maddox Brothers and Rose with? Do you know Maddox Brothers and Rose? It was an old radio show on the West Coast. And it was that kind of, you know, it was just like maybe the 30s or the 40s.
Yeah.
And it was one of those, gather round, folks, the Maddox Brothers and Rose. And they would do like a couple weird comedy bits.
Right.
That were,
I don't know,
stiff
if we
but charming.
Talked about that. Yeah.
And then they would go into the bluegrass.
Some songs. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great tradition of those, Porter Wagoner, you know, like these great old variety shows, be they television or radio, and Dolly Parton did some, and like some of these live specials. It's also a music that welcomes and people and kind of brings, I think, people together, like, you know, people who are fans of indie rock or hip hop or whatever, that's a which I am also, those are forms of music that it's usually a performer and an audience. And if you go to a music festival, an indie rock festival, you're going to different venues and you're watching these shows. When you go to a bluegrass festival, fully 60%, if not more, of the audience are also musicians. And you're walking around the campsites or the parking lot, and there's just infinite jam sessions going on. And sometimes some of these major artists are out there in the parking lots jamming along with fans. And it's the most inclusive dynamic relationship, kind of give and take with artists. I think it's part of what makes bluegrass, that world, that community, so special and unique.
It'd be kind of interesting to see almost like these weird covalent musical bonds where you have one group, one bluegrass group is walking and passing another, and then all of a sudden they just meld, and then when they break apart, like they've switched some of the instrumentation,
right.
But it just all blends right in. But I think
they switched some electrons.
Yeah. But I think part of what is part of what certainly made it work for the early days of radio is that all of the tones cut through. That for a low fidelity,
yes,
you have very bassy parts and very high parts, and like all of the pieces, they layer together very nicely, but no one tone is like any other tone in a bluegrass band, like vocally or with the instrumentation, and so it makes it very easy to hear. I mean, I just have these kind of like weird, almost peaceful fantasies about just being in a little house in the middle of nowhere, like in the early days of California, or, you know, where,
and hearing a crackly broadcast,
just sitting on a couch and just like hearing a crackly broadcast, just, and then like, that's your night.
Yeah.
It just feels, that sounds so peaceful to me.
Yeah. That can be yours.
I guess I could have that, right? If I really wanted
it. You could go
too easily distracted. No, I'm too easily distracted. Yeah. No, it's not possible anymore. We're way past it. Doesn't matter anymore.
Last time I went camping, I downloaded a bunch of like podcasts and things that I was like, oh, I'm going to sit out under the stars and listen to this stuff. And once I was out there, I just didn't even want to touch my phone. Yeah.
How often do you go camping?
Infrequently, but okay. A couple of times a year. Nope. I actually just got back from 8 nights of camping, rafting down the Colorado River.
How was that?
The Grand Canyon. Let me tell you something. It is transformative. It is
really
the most. There is a. Yeah, it just was life changing. Like, I am a more peaceful person now, and I think it's permanent.
Really?
I think it's not just
for the couple days after the trip?
I think the Grand Canyon, it just. I don't know what it. It's so awe inspiring. And fun and exciting. And also, we camped, but we never... Well, one night we slept in our tent because it rained. The rest of the nights were just out under the stars. And you can see... I counted 740 billion stars.
That's a lot. That's a big number.
Yeah. But you can see the Milky Way is just pouring all over your face.
So you're not
is
worried about like a bear snacking on your face or a spider laying eggs in your dick or anything?
First of all, I can think of nothing hotter than a spider laying eggs in my dick. I think that there's a pretty sure there's a fetish for that.
How do you like it, Dick? Says the spider.
But no, it's interesting. When you're in the Grand Canyon, it is its own ecology, and it's very limited because it's so. I mean, there's 2,000-foot cliffs all around, so the largest predator it's not even a predator. The largest animal was a bighorn sheep, and we barely ever saw them. The scariest thing are scorpions, and I saw one scorpion the whole time, and he had already been stepped on by accident. I did get a red ant bite, which doesn't sound bad, but it hurt like a motherfucker.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you see it happen or did you just feel it?
I felt it. And then I was like, oh, I got a red ant bite. And then our rafting guide was like, you should go pee in a bucket and just soak your foot in it for 5 minutes. And I was like, you know what? I'm in the wild. I'm going to do that. So I went and peed in a bucket and I soaked my ant sting in it. And I was like, this isn't that bad. And then like 45 minutes later, throbbing agony in my foot.
Really?
Yeah.
From the pee or the ant bite?
That's unclear. That's unclear.
So I peed in a bucket and put my foot in, like I said. What? I was fucking around. Really?
Don't you know that's toxic? You have a staph infection. We have to airlift you out of here.
Pee is waste. I thought it was sterile. Nah. That's a load of shit.
Also, that said, come to my tent later and pee on me, please. I will have a spider laying eggs in my dick.
I have some ant bites on my tongue, and
And I'm going to need you to sterilize this.
Well, I feel better already.
But like a couple of Advil and an hour later, it was fine. But,
totally fine.
But it's, yeah, usually I was, for some reason, the scorpions kind of got into my my psyche a little bit, and I was skittish about them. But I didn't really need to be. And it was, it just was incredible. The rapids on the Colorado River are so unfathomably huge. They're just, it's like, I didn't know that water could behave like that.
Well, they don't call them slopids. Come on, someone had to do that joke at some point. It is a Simpsons joke, right? Yeah.
Slopids?
Slopids.
Yeah.
Is it Homer that says?
It's a Ned Flanders when they're on the Boy Scout
trip. That's right! Oh, where they disappear and then they find the Krusty Burger on the oil rig?
Good call.
That is a classic.
Nice placement, by the way.
Ernest Borgnine's in that one, and he goes to find his trusty knife, but then Homer...
stolen.
Yeah, okay, good. It's all coming back.
Good, 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 good.
I just made a Ned Flanders joke.
Good. Did you do the marathon? Has that happened yet?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I caught... I mean, I would
the
jump in...
marathon?
I would jump in and catch some of it, you know, like whenever I could, but is the app out now?
Now, that wasn't commercial free, was it? That wasn't just like wall-to-wall Simpsons, because that would be balls. Like if they had
8 commercials for the entire run.
Okay.
Yeah, but I think I think Jonah said FXX's numbers like crushed everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
From that marathon. But every time I'm out, like I was just performing in Salt Lake and Seattle and Denver, and it's that kind of upper left-hand region of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Some call it the Pacific Northwest,
mm-hmm.
But you know, I wouldn't really count Utah as part of the Pacific or Denver. But,
no, upper left.
But the upper left quadrant of the country, it really is. I mean, like Utah is a whole different kind of stunning than Washington, which is different than Colorado, but it's so...
Yeah, our country has so many staggeringly beautiful places, and they're wildly different.
Yeah,
I am like to go from like Hawaii to the Grand Canyon could not be to Alaskan tundra, like all beautiful, all completely different. You need to do stand up in the Grand Canyon.
Just alone?
Yeah.
Or for the Scorpions?
Yeah, like for...
I mean the band.
For the ants. For the band.
That's where you know you're about to get bitten. You're about to get stung by a scorpion.
They warned you.
They start whistling
with the winds
of
change.
Yes.
Oh, I wish
Did you hear that?
True.
Oh, my God. it's getting louder.
Oh, God. I love it. I'd also like to step off an airplane anytime I landed in Europe and hear
the final countdown.
What else?
And then
what other
the moment
music
when you land in Asia?
What was I saying about the Grand Canyon?
You said it was transformative. You said you got bitten by a fire ant. A red ant. You said crazy rapids. You said, oh, here's what it was. You said, you were saying that the rapids were so unlike anything that you had ever seen that it was hard to really...
It can't be conveyed, the experience of riding through these...
And you're not freaked out at all?
Well, so there's different ways to actually run the river. You can run it in what's called a dory, which is like a fiberglass boat, kind of like a giant rowboat, essentially. And that will give you a very wild ride because it just gets pitched and those flip over and all kinds of stuff. You can ride it on a conventional like 6-person raft, which is also a very wild ride. Or you can do what we did because my mom came and some of my young nieces and nephews and a bunch of family. So we wanted sort of the safest, most comfortable run. And that was on these big kind of barge rafts that are virtually unflippable. So at no point are we concerned for our safety. It just was – it just is so massive and thrilling. It's like a roller coaster. That said, one guy in our party did get washed off a raft during a rapid. But even then, as big as the rapids are, they're not – and this could be grossly naive, but I don't think they're as dangerous as a lot of other kinds of rivers because the volume of water is so massive that it's not getting hung up on anything. It's not slamming you. Most rocks are submerged. It's you're going to wash through. So you have your life jacket on, and even though these waves are like 15 feet tall and smashing into you, and it's still water, and you're going to wash out of it.
Wow.
Whereas like other kinds of rivers, you know, that have different kinds of obstacle, like you can get trapped under things and get pinned into things. Those are really scary. Colorado River doesn't feel as scary, even though it's the biggest water I've ever seen.
And so you you just sort of park the boat every day and then get off, and then you're like, okay, let's
all day long, every day, you're going down the river, you're hitting huge rapids, and you're also stopping and taking these jaw-dropping hikes up into side canyons, and then around 4 o'clock each day, you find a beach that you pull over and set up camp.
God damn it, that sounds so great.
It's unbelievable. And even people on the trip, we had all family on this trip. So it was a good crowd. We knew everybody. But I think even most people who run it, you usually just sign up for a larger trip and then mm-hmm. you're with a group. It wouldn't matter. If you're with complete strangers, it's just you're going to have a great time. And I will say this too, like people who had limited outdoor experience – and were intimidated by the camping aspect and everything, just had a ball, you know, like were completely excited and thrilled the whole time. It's awesome.
And do you bring food for 8 days, or do you try to?
So you go, it's very heavily regulated. It's national park. So it's heavily regulated. And there are just a few guide companies that are permitted to run the river. They also issue a certain number of private permits per year, but we went with a guide company, and they outfit you with all of the supplies, essentially. And the guides really help a lot with cooking and all that kind of stuff. So it's not like the camping part is pretty easy.
You're not Survivor Man.
No, you're not Bear Grylls in it out there.
although I think when they're shooting those nature specials, a lot of time there's usually someone just off camera, just like handing them. Someone's gutted a snake and they've handed it to them, right?
Yeah, or it's like, I just need a corn dog real bad right now. Turn the camera off. Also on that trip, my two buddies, Jake and Ian, who are my college buddies with whom I still play music in the Lonesome Trio. That's mm-hmm. our little group that we've been playing together for 20 years. They were also on this trip, and we brought instruments and just played music every night.
Oh, like, man.
Yeah.
This sounds amazing.
In like the cathedral of Mother Nature, just resonating off canyon walls.
Are you completely off the grid? Do your phones work at all?
Completely off the grid, 8 days.
Wow.
We were all sort of, you know, wondering what major earth-changing event happened while we were in the camp.
Oh, hey, guys, turns the apocalypse happened.
Yeah.
Yep, no more civilization.
Well, turns out nothing different happened. Turns out you can go off the grid for 8 days and come back in without a hitch.
It turns out humanity was off the grid for 10,000 years.
Oh, this was great. So I set up an auto-reply on my email.
Yeah.
And it just said, hey, I'm on vacation and won't have access to email or phone, blah, blah, blah. Then I get back... And my inbox has 3,000 messages. And I was like, all right, well, I figured I'd have a bunch.
Yeah.
But 3,000 in 8 days, I think, is weird. So I start going through it, and I realized that what had happened was a spam, not like unknown spam, but something that I subscribe to or something, like a retailer or something, had just sent me a spam note, and I had auto replied to it, and then they had an auto reply.
So they were
kicking
back and forth.
They basically had a note that said, like, please don't reply to this email address. And it had turned into this like feedback loop
This. No, you don't reply to this. No, yeah. I mean it. You stop replying to
no,
this.
No, I'm out of town.
Well, I'm an auto-replier, and I'm telling you to stop auto-replying.
But I'm out of town.
Yeah, well, I'm an auto-replier, and I'm
but
telling
I'm
you to
stop. But I'm out of town.
But I'm telling you to stop auto-replying.
I'm telling you I can't.
No, I'm telling you.
You need to know you're the, I'm out of town.
I'm an auto-replier, though. This is what I was billed for, and you should not auto-reply to me.
I can't help it.
This is what I do. This is me.
It
me.
Just, and it me. Was like thousands of this. And thank God it happened like right towards the end of the week. Otherwise, I would have had like 10,000 messages. But that was – it made me wonder, though, how much of – like so this thing was happening in the internet that had no human oversight. It was a reflexive feedback loop of email
yep.
that no humans were monitoring or even aware of.
Right.
And it would have gone on indefinitely
mm-hmm.
had I not emerged from the canyon and put a stop to it. It made me wonder how many things like that are going on in the internet and just eating up ohms and watts of electricity.
You just
and
don't
just
see it because it's all, you know, it just gets kicked into spam filters or it's, you know, my email is very heavily filtered
uh-huh.
in ways where my main inbox never really has
yeah.
an exorbitant amount
right,
of,
right,
because
right.
everything's, you know.
No, but I'm not talking, I mean, I know this because most of my emails to you get kicked back to me.
That's not true.
But I'm just wondering, I'm not even talking email specifically. I mean, like, the way that that business, you know, like, online businesses work together, and there are all these automated things that are very possibly just getting in these feedback
I
loops.
Would love to find out what the oldest autoresponder is. Like, let's say there was a company from, like, 20 years ago, and the company folded or someone died or something, but it just kept spinning its wheels that it's just still floating out there somewhere. Just still like, please respond to me. Please respond yeah. to me. Please respond to me.
It's the, it's Jenny McCarthy at singledout.com.
.mtv.com. Is the Bluegrass Festival, it's in October, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I'm glad you asked. The bluegrasssituation.com is this really cool, fun resource for acoustic music fans, Americana fans. And it's something I helped start, and I'm really proud of it. And it's got great articles and music premieres and all kinds. It's sort of like the Pitchfork of that, of bluegrass.
Mm-hmm.
We have a signature festival, which is this October at the Ace Hotel, that new theater that got renovated at the Ace Hotel.
Oh, nice.
Downtown. Yeah.
Cause it was at Largo. Cause I did it at Largo.
Yeah, of course. That's right. You were on it. And the first, so the festival actually predates the bluegrasssituation.com, mm-hmm. which kind of grew out of the fun and success of the festival. But festival is kind of a liberal term. It was really just a weekend of programming at Largo that Flanny and I put together and booked a lot of our friends like you and Steve Martin and Steve Canyon Rangers and the Punch Brothers mm-hmm. and a bunch of – we just had – great luck out of the gate. And that was in 2010, I think, the first one. And it's just growing. It's been super cool and super fun. And we would like to have you back. Or
I would love to. No, I would love to because every time there's so many songs. I love making weird covers of songs. And I always want to do bluegrass covers of songs because it just – It's such a fun experiment to see how do you distill this bigger song down
right.
to like four basic elements.
Well, I will say that bluegrass covers of pop songs is kind of a touchy area for bluegrass fans because it feels like a lot of bluegrass fans feel like, oh, that's just easy, low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
You know, you can whatever. But occasionally one will break through that feels super authentic to both the spirit of the original song and the artists who are covering it in a kind of acoustic or bluegrass fashion. And it's really cool and exciting. I think we actually just did a posting on the bluegrasssituation.com of 8 or 9 of what we thought were the best covers of pop songs. And some of them, there's this one of this old banjo player playing solo and singing Beyonce's All the Single Ladies. And it's mind-blowing because the way he's singing it, it made this kind of beautiful connection between music. That's obviously like a crazy dance club song. And here's a guy playing it in a way that you'd never expect, but it sounds great. And it actually, when you hear it through this guy, you realize that some of Beyonce's melodies and the way that that she sang it is connected and harkens back to some of the old lines and traditions of older music, and it works.
What's the guy's name?
I can't remember.
It's on your site though?
Yeah, it's on the site.
The Bluegrass Situation.
Yeah, thebluegrasssituation.com, or I think bluegrasssituation.com will get you there too.
Who's playing this year?
So this year the lineup is, there's two nights. Friday night, October 10th, is sort of a more traditional night, a nod towards more traditional music with the Carolina Chocolate Drops, who are fantastic, Josh Ritter, and Willie Watson, who is really an incredible old-time player. He just sounds... He's timeless, Willie Watson. It just sounds like he could be on a train through St. Louis in 1920 or, you know, playing at Staples Center. that's Friday night. Saturday night, October 11th, is more... getting into the more progressive area with some indie rock bands that cross over into acoustic bluegrassy stuff. Lord Huron, Blind Pilot, Langhorne Slim, and Shaky Graves. And I can't believe the people we got. I think this lineup is unreal. It's going to be nuts.
And is everyone playing full sets or just like short sets?
It'll be, probably not full sets, like an hour each, but good. I'm actually not sure how it's going to be distributed, but everyone will get a good chunk of time.
That's great. And are you looking to do this more than once a year or tour it? Or
that's a great question. We've popped up at other events. I hosted a stage at Bonnaroo the last 2 years, the Bluegrass Situation stage, which was such a blast. We basically had 5 artists throughout the course of a day. We had like one day. Sorry, I'm jumbling up here. I hosted this stage at Bonnaroo where for one full day, the Bluegrass Situation curated a stage. Mm-hmm. We had 5 artists. And then at the end, we had this super jam, which I hosted and played in. And we had most of the artists from that day would play, and then a bunch of guest people kind of out of nowhere showed up, and even some people like this year, Dierks Bentley just showed up from Nashville because I texted him and he wanted to be there, and then the Avett Brothers had just finished a set on the main stage, and so they popped over and we did a song, and it was super super fun. So that's a little bit of what we're doing outside of the LA festival. Bonnaroo, we also have we cover a lot of stuff like at the Telluride Bluegrass Festival and Merle Fest and the Newport Folk Festival. We're having kind of a presence at those things. But I think our mothership is really this LA festival, which we're still growing. And I think it, the potential is enormous.
Well, and just in case people, I'm sure most people know, but you are a banjo player and a damn fine banjo player.
Thank you.
How often do you practice?
It varies. Sometimes, like if I'm in production on a movie or something, very little. But if I know I have a show coming up and I go into panic mode, and I can be practicing 4 hours a day. So it's a bit of a crapshoot.
Banjo to me feels like an instrument where if you don't practice regularly...
Oh, yeah. You get rusty.
Yeah. Because at least, you know, like if you're with guitar, unless you're doing a ton of solos, obviously you would need to practice that. But it just feels like with banjo, there's so much finger articulation.
It's all dexterity. And what I find I lose, and it's the most frustrating thing if I don't play regularly, is precise timing, which you kind of take for granted when you hear it. When you hear banjo players that are good, you don't notice how perfect their syncopation and their timing is. But when you don't play regular, you just lose that muscle memory for like precise metronomic timing. And when you play banjo not in that time, it is the worst sounding thing imaginable. It's like 1,000 scorpion bites.
What, all at once?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. That feels like I don't know if just playing off time a little bit is really the equivalent of 1,000 scorpion. Like, that would kill
remember this. Scorpions ordinarily sting you with their tail. So when they bite you, it's just kind of mildly irritating.
Right. It's just out of here.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of... But a thousand of those. I would love to do this. What did we do together? We did
the Titanic theme.
That's right. We did a mashup of bluegrass, adult contemporary, and hair metal.
Yes, and I had my costume from Rock of Ages.
Yes,
and so I
and you, know. You were you sang the Titanic theme song. Yeah. As a hairband dude, which sounds amazing.
But then you guys were all...
And then we played it acoustically as a bluegrass band underneath you. That was super fun.
And then you all came with a voice like, near, far, wherever you are. Like you guys were... Yeah. You all came in with all the harmonies.
Yeah, that was fun. That's good stuff.
It was really fun. Because you guys started playing... And I don't think everyone knew what the song was at first. And then I came from off stage, like, dressed like a moron.
Right.
Just, you know, whatever the first lyrics are. And then they immediately saw what the song was.
Out across the water.
Oh, is that it?
Something like that, yeah.
Far. Yeah, I don't remember what
it was. Then the chorus.
Yeah.
Near, far, wherever you are.
Oh, that's right. And then for some reason... I started running around in circles and knocking everything over on stage. Like I went for some reason. Well,
the reason being that it was hilarious and fantastic.
No, I was really invested in the character.
Yeah, I was like, where is Chris?
Yeah, I wasn't
for the
there,
entire
man.
Duration of that bit.
It's like it was hard to, you know, it was hard to take the wig off metaphorically.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Believe me.
It was always.
I could feel it. It was,
but that was really fun. That was but the whole show was great. And like, wasn't Noam,
Noam Pichelny from the Punch Brothers.
Yeah.
And that night, that show, which we did as part of the LA Bluegrass Situation Festival, was a show that I do from time to time at Largo called the Whiskey Sour Radio Hour, mm-hmm. which is more of that variety show. There's a lot of comedy mixed in.
Yeah.
We're not doing that this year as part of the festival. Partly because this new venue is just such a more of a music venue, but I think the hope is to really stay true to those roots of those first few years of the LA Bluegrass Situation, which had so many great comedy people coming in. Will Ferrell came and did it one year, and Jenny Slate and all these, Nick Kroll, so many people popping in to just do fun bits as part of the evenings. Sean and Sarah Watkins also did their Watkins Family Hour, so which is good. A phenomenal show they do at Largo. And
we put some of them out as podcasts.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
So I called Sarah about a month ago and I just I said, you know, I just want to start making weird covers of songs. Would you? And she was like, yeah, I'm on tour, but when I get back. And so, I mean, it just it's kind of fun to know that and they're like world-class musicians.
And in my view, kind of the heart and soul of the Los Angeles bluegrass acoustic music scene, because they've been at it for so long. They are from here. They're from Southern California. Their show at Largo, the Watkins Family Hour, to me is like just the best that there is. The best of what LA has to offer in that vein, and they happen to be fantastic people too.
I mean, again, it just picturing California in a pre-freeway time,
mm-hmm.
where you do kind of get this driving across country, or driving if you drive up to San Francisco late at night or something, but where you're just in the middle of nowhere and you're just listening to AM radio. You know, my dad hated flying, and so we drove a lot all over the country when I was a kid. Mostly Tennessee, but we would drive, you know, my dad had this big white Cadillac that he called Bertha. And so we would just drive. I mean, I just remember Blake curling up in the back seat.
Yeah.
And just listening to AM radio, just that really lo-fi, crackly, you know, and then
totally,
and then hearing these old radio shows or hearing old. I mean, I don't know if this makes sense. It's comfortingly eerie because you're so isolated, but you're in this vehicle. I don't know.
No, I completely relate. I think like we did big road trips in our Oldsmobile station wagon. And we were back and forth to Nashville. I grew up in Atlanta, and my mom's family was in Nashville. So we were back and forth to there all the time when I was a kid. And I would just curl up in the way back, and it would be, you know, it could be AM sports radio that my dad was listening to, and just the hum of the freeway, the sort of hypnotic rhythm of the street lights over the freeway,
mm-hmm.
if it was nighttime, and the knowledge, and just a family being quiet together, and the knowledge that my parents kind of have everything under control.
Yeah.
You know, cause when you're five, you don't really take stock in that. But when you look back on it, you can be like, that is what was so comfortable.
And
like,
then you get old and you realize your parents were just faking it.
Yes, totally.
What? You mean you didn't know anything? You're a fraud.
Oh, my God.
Did you ever stop at I remember we would always stop at Cracker Barrels, and we'd always stop at Stuckey's. Did you guys stop at the Stuckey's?
Of course.
Stuckey's had those gross nut rolls that were like these weird marshmallow nut rolls that were good for like two bites. And then it was, and then I couldn't stomach it anymore.
God, Stuckey's had so much. That was like going into Christmas every time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Stuckey's on I-75 that took us up to Nashville. There was a Dairy Queen right on the top of Mont Eagle, which is a mountain pass that you go through. And we would always stop at that Dairy Queen. And I would get a Butterfinger Blizzard,
uh-huh.
which I still to this day believe is nectar from Jesus's nipple. Is that sacrilegious? I don't know.
No.
But
what, you know, if you're a religious person, there's no reason that Jesus couldn't have a delicious blizzard coming out of his nipple.
No,
I mean, that's divine.
I think it is. I think it is. Yeah, those were that. And I actually believe it's funny you brought up Stuckey's, because we would stop at those truck stops and refuel and go in and get some beef jerky or whatever. And also from time to time, we would grab some of those cassette tapes that were on the counter for sale. And a lot of those were in that region. They might be like Appalachian string music or that. And I think that was some of my earliest exposure, were some of those weird truck stop cassette tapes of Appalachian music
that you would never find in any other music store.
Of course. And they were, I mean, of course the tape selection was varied, that there would be like, you know, The Cars, Heartbeat City, and Whitesnake, yeah. and The Scorpions, and then like a couple of weird things like a comedy cassette, or and then the Appalachian string music or something. But my mom, who grew up in Nashville, had some inkling. She wasn't a big fan of acoustic music, but she did like it, and we would pick up those cassettes, and some of those I think were where I first kind of got that taste for that music.
Yeah, I remember that it's the same exact thing, and a lot of times you didn't really even know exactly what you were buying. You're like, well, we just need to kill time somehow, because mm-hmm. you can get so much on the open road at that time where there you just couldn't hold the station for longer than like
right.
30 minutes.
Right, right.
Even AM, you know, would cut out. So I was like, well, we got to listen to something.
Yeah. Well, also when you get up into some of the countryside up there, a lot of AM radio is very religious.
Oh, yeah.
And at times like kind of unpleasant.
And then
like,
Jesus said, with yeah. the blizzard that sprang forth from his nipple.
Yeah. With the Butterfinger blizzard squirting out of his nipple.
Jesus was delicious.
But it's, yeah, and my parents didn't go in for the religious stuff very much.
Is this a segue into the fact, are you doing vacation?
Yes. In what way is that a segue?
Because you were talking about being in a station wagon.
Oh, road trips. Yeah, of course. Great segue.
Right? You said you were in the station wagon.
I immediately
thought vacation.
I'm doing vacation. I leave. By the time this podcast airs, mm-hmm. I will be on set. I leave Thursday for production.
What is the... I heard what someone said, oh, the plot is this. But is it Rusty's grown up? Is that
so?
The plot?
Yes, that is exactly it, and it's kind of the only. It was my entry into this.
Are you Rusty Griswold?
This. I am Rusty Griswold.
Come on,
yes,
that's weird, isn't it? That's weird. You're
it's
a guy.
Weird.
Like that's no. It's weird in the sense that this movie was such a part of our comedy development, that was so much a part of our pop culture.
Yes.
That if anyone asked you, what are your 10 favorite comedies, Vacation would probably be in the top 10.
Totally.
And now you're...
A guy.
Anthony Michael Hall grew up to be you.
That's right.
I mean, I know the other ones were great. I know European Vacation... I mean, I think Christmas Vacation was better than European Vacation, but I
rank them differently. To me, it's Vacation... Actually, in order. I think in order, they got... The best one that's like best, you know, on down the line. But originally I got the script and I had a meeting with one of the producers and I just was like, why would I do this? I mean, this is such a sacred cow for me. I'm just not the idea of redoing this story and taking Chevy Chase's role in some way just didn't feel right. It didn't mm-hmm. feel like something I wanted to do. And then my manager was like, just read it. Just read the script and make an intelligent decision here. Most of my decisions are not made intelligently. So I followed his advice. I read the script and I realized by page 10, oh, this is Rusty Griswold's movie. This isn't just a redoing of the Clark Griswold family story. Rusty is all grown up. This takes place in the world that we already know.
Right.
It's really a continuation of the Griswold family saga. And that kind of, I thought right away, I was like, oh, that's cool. Like, that's kind of fun. And then I got through the script and the writers, John Francis Daly of Freaks and Geeks,
yep.
and Jonathan Goldstein, it was so funny. It was so fun and light and just like, family comedy and all the stuff that I remembered loving about those movies. It's its own movie. It's different, but it's respectful. It just felt like a good fit.
It's time to check in on the Griswolds again.
Yeah,
to find
right?
out where they are in their life.
Yeah.
So you're doing this and then Son of Fletch. And then,
I'm not doing Fletch. I'm doing Son of Fletch.
Son of Fletch.
Yes. Yeah, and then I'm doing Modern Problems.
Oh my God. I literally just thought, you know, that's so crazy that you say that.
Funny Farm.
No, you're good. Whatever. I just thought about Modern Problems the other day. I was landing somewhere because I've been on so many airplanes in the last couple of weeks. And, you know, he was an air traffic controller in the movie. So for some reason, I thought about the thing where he first gets his powers and then there's that airplane ashtray that, like, flies and he's mad on the phone. And I fucking love Dabney Coleman in that, because he's – Chevy's pretty straight in that movie, actually. He's kind of a
– he's just a – he's a very – well, he gets crazy towards the end. But yeah, he's sort of the he's a normal guy who gets these superpowers because his car fills up with toxic waste.
Which, as you know, does not give you terrible cancer ways. It's just you get telekinesis.
And you have a beautiful green glow.
Yeah.
That's very reminiscent.
And you can make your wife orgasm with your brain, your girlfriend orgasm with your brain.
Yeah. He had the exact same glow, I believe, as, oh my God, what's the crazy little fat blob ghost in Ghostbusters?
Slimer.
Yes, yeah. Of course. They had the same green glow.
Yep.
I believe that was the...
that was the standard effect.
The peak of visual effects at the time. But yeah, Dabney Coleman, who is one of my favorite comedy actors of all time. 9 to 5, he is brilliant in that movie.
He's amazing in everything.
He's amazing at Cloak and Dagger. Down the line.
Do you remember... Short Time? Short Time.
I don't remember that.
Short
what is
Time
that?
Is a movie where he's a cop.
Of course. And he finds out.
They tell him he's got like a week to live.
Yeah.
So he wants to die on the job
so that his family gets the insurance.
And so he becomes like this crazy super cop.
That's amazing. Like, what a brilliant premise.
Yeah. And it's just him being like, get him, run the fucking car. It's like him jumping cars over things. And then, of course, you know, like.
That was a time when those premises were new and they were like fresh and real. And then, like, and all the great movie premises cashed in the 80s. And now we're just rehashing them.
But yeah, Dabney.
I totally remember that movie. That's so funny.
When Dabney was like a leading man. Like he could open, like Dabney Coleman could open a movie.
Yeah.
And he was in, he was in Boardwalk, right? He was in Boardwalk Empire, but I think that was the last.
I'm sad to say that now when I try to picture Dabney Coleman, my brain goes to Dr. Phil. That's an unfortunate thing. And I need to go get on, I need to Google Dabney quickly to wash Dr. Phil out of my mind's eye.
Yeah, well, I just think in general you should try to wash Dr. Phil out of your mind's eye. And then the Dabney Coleman thing hopefully will wash
with
it.
Yes.
But that's what a great cameo opportunity, a Dabney Coleman. I wonder if he's still, I mean, the stuff I saw him in Boardwalk Empire, he was great, but I wonder if he's still super.
Yeah.
If you put him in a good comedy role, I wonder if he'd still be on top of it.
Don't know.
Well, let's find out.
Yes, indeed.
Put him in vacation.
We will stop in and see Rusty has his own kids, so we'll stop in and see the grandparents.
Of course.
Chevy and Beverly.
Nice.
At one point in the movie. And I just can't. I feel very honored and at the same time incredibly excited to be a Griswold.
To be the new number one Griswold, Rusty.
I mean, I hesitate to say the number one Griswold. It may always be Clark.
I know, but, you know, listen, circle of life.
Sure.
There should be the scene at the end of the movie where you have to take off his head and hold it up. What if you just found the Griswolds? Because it is kind of a horror-sounding name. What if it just turned out that they were kind of like the Addams Family, but you didn't know? Because you don't really ever see them at home.
No,
you only
true.
Ever see them out in the world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The beginning of the first vacation is kind of as much of the home we see.
If you found out that Clark had been a serial killer, and if you track all the different movies that there had been like a number of murders like in the Midwest and then in Europe and then around Christmas time around I don't think it'd be weird. I think you would be like, oh
yeah, you could buy that.
That's why, you know, like that's why he was trying so hard to approximate like what a normal family would go do, because he was trying to keep up the appearance.
Yeah, he was trying too hard.
Yeah. And that's why
I would love to see, you know, when they cut trailers of genre movies to be different genres.
Yes.
I would love to see the Griswold horror genre trailer.
I'm surprised that hasn't been done.
It may have been done. It may have been done.
Are you guys going to Wally World?
I am not at liberty to discuss.
It's a free country, man. It's a free country, man.
I'm just going to say it's in the book.
Fuck
no, me. No. That's those Time Life books. Remember those commercials?
Yeah.
It's in the book.
Was that Time Life, the Time Life books?
No, it was some kind of encyclopedia series or something.
Oh. That was the, you're talking about with the kid?
No. Not the Britannica.
Right. Who was Stan Freberg's kid?
Who?
Stan Freberg, who's a old-timey comedian guy. Stan Freberg, that was his kid.
Wow. The Encyclopedia Britannica guy.
Yeah.
With long hair and glasses.
The poor kid who probably...
And hammer pants. And he wore like hammer pants and a vest.
And then he'd be like, we're going to flash the number on the bottom of the screen. He'd go, excellent. Like,
yeah.
They wanted like a snarky David Spade type kid.
Right, right.
In the 90s. It was very much a product of like... It was like in the 90s when we were just starting to toy with sarcasm and irony. And so
he did a good job. He did a good job with it. But I'll never forget, whenever they flashed the number on the screen and he'd like look at it and interact with it, his eye line was always off. That infuriated me.
And he just had this bad relationship to the voiceover, and he was in this weird neutral environment that felt like they've imprisoned this child.
Yeah.
And this guy is just taunting him, and the only connection this kid has to the outside world is that voice in the books. And so the kid's just naturally prickly.
Right.
He just doesn't know. He's been raised in captivity.
No, what was the book series that was where it's like a guy telling, every commercial was someone telling someone about the books?
It's in the book.
And then they would say, well, so what happens? And they got, and then the answer was always, it's in the book.
I don't know. I know what you're
talking about. Does that ring a bell?
It could be a Time Life series.
I think it was like a science,
is it Mysteries of the Unknown?
Something like that.
Or is it?
It's like, it tells you how the Grand Canyon was formed. Well, how was it formed? It's in the book.
It's in the book.
By the book.
I can't remember what that was.
Anyway, it's in the script, I should say, what the Griswold, what Rusty Griswold's family does is in the script, and it will be in the movie, and you will need to see it.
Now, is Rusty married to his sister? Because they had a weird chemistry in the first movie.
Rusty is not married to his sister, thankfully.
Okay.
So, Mysteries of the Unknown.
Mysteries of the Unknown!
There it is! Great call. It's in the book. That Time Life Mysteries of the Unknown might actually tell you the plot of Vacation as well.
Really?
I don't know. I can't verify that. But it might be in the book.
The plot of this Vacation movie was in an Incan
Yes.
An old Incan wall print.
Yeah, the original painting. Vacation was a remake of an Incan pictograph that entertained thousands of Incans
for
centuries.
What is the movie called?
It's called Vacation.
This is called Vacation?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm super excited about it.
So the Bluegrass Festival is at the Ace Hotel.
The LA Bluegrass Situation at the
October.
Ace Hotel, 10th and 11th of October.
TheBluegrassSituation.com. Ed Helms on Twitter. Anything else you want to
plug? Go down the Grand Canyon.
You want to plug the Grand Canyon?
I want to plug the Grand Canyon. I don't want to actually plug it.
No, that would be terrible.
The Hoover Dam
has
done a good job of that.
Yep.
Or a terrible job of it, depending on your point of view.
Oh, the Hoover Dam is terrifying.
Well, the Glen Canyon Dam is above the Grand Canyon, and the Hoover Dam is below it.
Getting skeeved even just talking about the Hoover Dam. I went there earlier this year.
Why? Why are you? Well, you're
because it's so there's you would die in such a horrible way. Like it's so big that when you're walking on the dam, like when you're
across
driving up
it?
The dam and then you're walking across it, I just kind of get that prickly feeling in my extremities.
Yeah.
Where it just feels like it's too high. And then you see there's even like a higher part where people can look down on it. And it's like even looking up there.
You have a heights thing.
I guess I do. I mean, I have a heights thing, but I have a thing. It's not so much.
I understand what you mean. Like things that are man-made and massive are
massive.
Terrifying. Yeah.
Yes.
Like
massive.
Like I was once in a little like rubber, you know, like Zodiac kind of thing with an outboard motor.
Yeah.
And we were just going from like a dock to my cousin's sailboat or something. And we went by, this was in Oakland, which is one of the biggest container ship ports in the country.
Yeah.
And we drove by a container ship in our little Zodiac thingy. And the scale of it was so terrifying. I couldn't even tell you what I was afraid of. I just had this like deep dread and terror of this giant ship.
Because you have to imagine that going back to the lizard brain.
Yeah.
Nothing should be that big.
Yeah, you're right.
It's
a very lizard brain.
Proto Man. If Proto Man sees something that big, it's going to kill you.
Yeah.
It's not, whatever that is not a good thing.
Right.
So it just feels automatically
wrong.
Deadly.
And the Hoover Dam did that to you.
Yeah, it did that to me. And it's.
Doesn't the Hoover Dam also have the crazy intake thing that's like a giant black hole? Like if you look into Lake Mead, there's an intake that would just like suck you into oblivion and grind you through the electric turbines and then spit you out the spillway.
I don't know. I didn't look that far. It was very hard for me to, like, I had to inch my way up to it. And then they have these bathrooms and everything sort of looks like, you know, like Art Deco.
Right, right. It's all very like Marvel comic villain.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. It looks like
Lex Luthor's,
yes,
palace.
That's right. And it is it was really terrifying to me and I had to, it was one of those things where I'm like, okay, you know, you gotta get past
that. That's spooky.
Yeah.
Well, the Grand Canyon, still worth it.
Yep, still worth it to go.
Yep.
And now I might actually take a vacation there. I mean, I'm sure there's only a handful of months out of the year where you can actually do that, right? You can't.
I think it's a lot of months. It's like September, or it's spring, early spring through fall.
Okay.
Yeah. And they run it year round. It just gets insane because it does get super cold. But the hardcore people do it year round. Don't do it by yourself in an inner tube.
What?
Go with a professional.
Why? So you shouldn't do this thing that people used to do, like that stunt people in the 1930s would do. It's like, oh, I'm going to get in a barrel and go over the Niagara Falls.
Yeah.
Oh, that guy died.
Hey, I'm going to get in this barrel. Drop me off the Empire State Building.
Yeah.
Guess what? Barrel. Not
not protective at all.
Not the same as a...
It's just a murder tube.
Yeah.
It's just gonna barrel. No, because if I'm in the barrel, it's gonna take the brunt of the force, and I'll be okay.
I'll be fine.
No. It's gonna try to squish you out.
If you don't suffocate first, you will also get smashed.
and
you will die of a million splinters.
It'll spit you like a jizz wad out of the opening.
The bunghole.
Yeah.
That's actually called the bunghole. The hole in the top of a barrel is literally called that.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
That's exactly what would happen. So don't go off things in barrels, please. But do go to thebluegrasssituation.com. Ed Helms, thank you so much for being
Thanks
here.
Thanks a lot. This has been a blast.
It's always good to see you. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Indeed.
Another brother noticed me. I'm up on his, up on me. Don't pay him any attention. Cried my tears 3 long years. Now you can't be mad at me. Hit me like daddy should put a ring on it. Hit me like daddy should put a ring on it. Don't be mad when you see that he won. Hit me like daddy should put a ring on it. Oh, oh, oh. Gonna learn my reason blindness me. If you like attention, put a ring on. If you like attention.
Don't be mad, don't see that he wanted. If you like it, then you should have put a ring on. Oh, 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 oh. Things of this world. Well, I'm not that kind of a girl. Your love is what I prefer. What I deserve is a man who will make me and take me and deliver me to a destiny, to infinity and beyond. So pull me in your arms, say I'm the one you own, because if you don't, you'll be alone and like a ghost. Well, I'll be gone. All single ladies, put your hands up. If you like it, then you should put a ring on it. If you like it, then you should put a ring on it. Don't be mad when you see that he wants it. If you like it, then you should put a ring on it. Oh, 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 oh,
And dragged from the internet onto the end of the Nerdist podcast was Neil Hankin with all the single ladies. You can go to his YouTube page, which is Neil Hankin. And that's what we just talked about on the podcast that you just listened to. See how things pay off sometimes. It's worth it to stay all the way through and not bail out halfway through a podcast. And ye has been rewarded with the blue grassiest of treats. Ha 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 ha.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies and brands to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.